Welcome to the Startup Grind podcast.
Starting a company is not for the faint of heart.
It's always questioning, tweaking.
Where we talk to entrepreneurs, venture capitalists, and thought leaders about how to build a great company.
Like my friends, like, you think you're crazy.
I think you got to be a little nuts.
And change the world in the process.
We optimize for impact instead of profit.
It's never been a more exciting time to be an entrepreneur.
From Startup Grind chapters across the globe.
The chapter director for Cape Town.
Boise, Idaho.
London.
Mala, Palestine.
Guangzhou, China.
And delivered to you every Monday and Wednesday.
It's a Startup Grind.
Hey there, and welcome to Wednesday's episode of the Startup Grind podcast. Today we have a conversation from the VC Corner stage at Startup Grind's global conference held each year in Silicon Valley. Joining us today is a presentation by Clara Brenner, co-founder and CEO of the Tumble Urban Solutions Accelerator, which has supported companies like HandUp, Chariot, and PopUpsters solve problems specific to cities and dense populations. Prior to founding Tumble, she worked in real estate development at a real estate tech startup called Fundrise, as well as Acom, GVA Advantis, and Momentum Realty. Clara earned her MBA from the MIT Sloan and her BA from NYU. She's a member of the MIT Sloan Alumni Board. In January 2014, Forbes listed her as one of its 30 under 30 for social entrepreneurship. Let's listen in to Clara Brenner live from the VC stage at Startup Grind's Global Conference.
Hey guys, how are you doing? Last talk of the day. My name is Clara Brenner. I'm the co-founder and CEO of Tumble. Tumble is an organization based here in San Francisco with the mission of empowering entrepreneurs to solve city problems. And we do that by investing in really early stage businesses that we think have the potential to address really core urban challenges like transportation, waste and resource management, homelessness. We also give them office space. We kind of mentor them. And we're usually the first check in the door, or if not the first, then one of the very first. So I figured I would just talk to you guys today, like I talk to a lot of our portfolio companies as they think about raising their sort of earliest round of funding, if that's cool with you guys. Awesome. So I'll just give you a really quick overview of Tumble. I think then I'll give you some real case studies of Tumble companies and how they've gone about raising their seed round. I'll go in a little bit more depth about who typically invests in those types of rounds and give you some tips for pitching those specific investors. And I'll try and leave a lot of questions time at the end, so feel free to jump in with questions throughout or at the end. So that's me and Julie, my co-founder. We started Tumble about 3 years ago. To date, I think we've worked with 33 companies. They've gone on to raise about $40 million in follow-on seed funding. So we spend a lot of time working on specifically this problem that we're going to talk about today. Not only do they work with us and get capital from us, but they also work pretty specifically with leaders in the urban space. So they'll work with the head of civic partnerships for Airbnb to think through, you know, how to develop local government engagement strategy as you look to scale, or the CTO of Lyft, you know, how do you scale your back-end technology from one city to five cities. But the reason we're all here today is to talk about entrepreneurs raising seed funding. So just to give you some context, when we look for investments, we look for startups that are solving problems that have maybe been identified by mayor's offices across the US as real priorities, but that they haven't necessarily been able to solve on their own yet. So problems like transportation. So we worked with a company called Hitch. They're a tech-enabled carpooling service. They were acquired by Lyft. They're now the backbone technology of Lyft Line. But right after they left the Tumble program, they ended up raising a seed round. And their strategy was really targeting what they were calling celebrity investors. They really wanted a few very high-profile investors, and they were determined to really raise through the AngelList platform. So they spent all of their time really targeting those few individuals that you read about every day in TechCrunch. And then immediately tried to throw their the rest of the roundup on AngelList to fill that out. And that worked really well because within less than a year of finishing the Tumble program, they were acquired by Lyft. Another big challenge that we think about a lot, especially here in the Bay Area, is homelessness. So we invested in a company called HandUp. They're a crowdfunding platform for the homeless that some of you might be familiar with. And their strategy was to really target angels. And they, I think they had 17 angels in their round. And incidentally, none of them, other than us, were impact-oriented. So something to think about. I mean, I can't think of something that sounds more social than a crowdfunding platform for the homeless. They since went on to get a grant from Google. I know they really wanted a grant from Google first. But it's really hard to raise that type of grant funding, especially, I think they got $500,000 from Google. It's really hard to get that funding when you don't have any other funding. I know that sounds crazy, but usually grant-making philanthropic organizations are not going to be your first capital in the door. Another issue we talk a lot about at Tumul is identifying capital for like big infrastructure projects and things like that in cities. So we invested in a company called Neighborly. They went on to raise about, I think, $5.4 million in seed funding. And they actually did get a few grants early on. So they got one from Knight Foundation, and they also got one from Sunlight Foundation. They were pretty small, but enough for them to kind of get through their proof of concept stage. And then they went on to raise traditional seed funding. I think it was led by, or a significant portion of their capital came from Formation 8. Drought, water planning, obviously a big problem here in San Francisco, but also elsewhere. So we invested in a company called Valor Water Analytics. They're like a big data solution for water utilities. And their strategy was to really target industry experts, so not necessarily traditional angel investors, micro VCs, but really going after folks who were leaders in their professional space, so like water resource experts, financial planning experts for water utilities, because they would really get something super wonky like this that maybe traditional investors would need a little bit more time to wrap their brain around, and that's how they raised their first round. And finally, job training, so finding opportunities to train our youth to be better prepared for the workforce. So we invested in a company called The Town Kitchen. They're kind of like a Sprig, except that they actually employ low-income youth, age 18 to 24, in their facilities. So they actually give them, you know, well-paying jobs, benefits, but also put them through essentially a culinary training program. And when they started, they actually did a Kickstarter. I think it was $40,000 that they raised through Kickstarter. They got a little bit of funding from Tumul, and they haven't raised any follow-on funding. They have a pretty impressive revenue run rate, and so we'll see if they actually ever raise any additional funding at all. But hopefully that gives you kind of a brief overview of some of the ways in which you can go about raising your earliest stage capital. The big thing that we talk about with our companies right now is the fact that, you know, seed really is the new Series A. There is a much higher bar that Series A investors are looking for companies to hit before they're going to take a risk on them. And so we see entrepreneurs focusing more on seed, raising multiple seed rounds, and really having to be creative in order to kind of find that capital. So it might be crowdfunding, it might be angels, it might be multiple angel rounds. You're seeing the seed extension, seed plus, seed two, seed three. It happens, and it's happening more frequently. At least that's what we're seeing. One thing we talk about with our companies is they think about approaching different types of investors, whether they're angels, micro VCs, venture capitalists, foundations, is really understanding what their motivations are. I think that sounds pretty obvious, but they oftentimes have very different financial motivations, mission-related motivations, traction expectations. You know, one example might be that when you pitch angel investors, they'll oftentimes ask you what your exit strategy is. They want to know, since they're usually very small checks and they're going to get diluted out pretty quickly, they'd like to know that you have a plan to get their money back. If you talked about your exit plan with a traditional venture capitalist, that would be a huge turnoff. They want to know that you are a founder that's going to be with that business till it becomes that billion-dollar unicorn that they really need. So just be aware of who you're talking to and who you're pitching, and you're going to have to tailor your messaging appropriately. I think a good way when you start thinking about how to tailor that message is to start by thinking about the math. So a typical seed investment that you see these days is about $500,000 to $2 million, and you should expect to lose up to about a third of your company in that seed round. Traditional investors, institutional micro VCs, venture capitalists are looking to make between 3 and 4x of their fund back throughout the life of their fund, which is usually 10 years. Which means that the investments they make could be radically different. So a micro VC could be really happy with a $100 million exit from a particular portfolio company, whereas for a venture capital firm that's $200 million, they need a much larger exit in order to be able to guarantee that 3 to 4x return. Does everybody understand that math? I'm happy to go through it. Just raise your hand if you want me to go through it. Okay, so what's a good example? I'm going to like really like simplify this down, but okay, say I'm a $20 million micro VC. I'm investing in your company and you have, I'm investing in your company and I take 20% of your company, okay? And you have a $100 million exit. I get, very simple math, I get $20 million back. My $20 million fund, I've already made back my entire fund. That's a reasonable well, that's kind of a great outcome for me. I only have to make a few investments like that in order to be able to achieve that 3 to 4x return, which basically means I need to find about $60 million total. I'm well on my way with my $20 million return from you. If I'm a $200 million fund and I do that same investment and I get $20 million back, that sucks. I have to do a lot of investments like you in order to be able to get to, let's see, if I'm a $200 million fund, I want $600 million back. So I don't want to invest in you. I want to invest in the company that's going to have a billion-dollar exit, and I'm going to get $200 million back, if that makes sense. Sorry, I probably should have made a slide like that. But anyway, just so you guys get that, they have very different return expectations, and it's not you, it's them. They need the types of exits that they need in order to be able to guarantee that 3 to 4x return for their investors. Impact investors. We get asked about impact investors a lot, and frankly, this is something that we were really surprised about the more we learned about it. Impact investors at the seed stage don't exist at all. I think the Global Impact Investing Network and JP Morgan did a study of all of the impact dollars that are out there in the world right now just floating around. It's about $60 billion, and of those dollars, only about 3% are earmarked for early stage investing. That's like $2 billion, less than that. That's like what Uber raised in its last round. That's like nothing. It's also very, very hard to get that small pool of money. So impact investors have really high expectations in terms of an entrepreneur's ability to quantify their impact, and they want to be able to know that in a year or 5 years, you're going to be working on exactly the problem that you said you were going to be working on. And I think, as you all probably know, entrepreneurs cannot possibly guarantee that. It's all about pivoting and responding to customer needs, and you have no ability to guarantee that the impact that you want to have is the impact that you will have. So oftentimes there's a real mismatch between impact investors and early stage entrepreneurs. Additionally, I think we did a study of AngelList maybe a couple months ago, and only about 2% of the angels on AngelList, which is arguably the most comprehensive sort of list of angels in the US, only about 2% self-identified as having impact as a real priority. That doesn't mean that they won't invest in an impact-oriented company. It just means that they're going to invest for other reasons. So we've had impact investors interested in, say, a water utility company, but it's because they're interested in software as a service, or they're interested in water, but they're not necessarily first and foremost caring about impact. That doesn't mean you should hide your impact. It just means when we talk to our companies about pitching their businesses, some of which are very impact-oriented, like, say, a HandUp, it means don't lead with impact. Start with your business model. Start with your potential profitability and, you know, finish with your impact. It's not necessarily a negative. It's just not really a selling point for any early-stage investors. Pitching your startup. So I think we've actually looked at something more like 750 deals at this point. And we get pitched a lot, and there's sort of like certain pieces of feedback that we find ourselves giving again and again to startups. So I'll just quickly run through some of those. The first is not really sounding technical enough. Again, no seed investors are first and foremost motivated by impact, or I should say nearly none. And this means that getting them to part with their money is probably the hardest thing you can do. Nobody likes to give away their money, and they want to know that whoever they're giving it to is going to be a really excellent steward of that capital. So the more technical you can sound, especially if you're in an impact space, the better off you'll be. The second is not giving your team enough love. When you're doing seed investing, you really aren't investing in the product. You're investing in the team. That's all we have to go with at that point. So being able to talk about the complementary skills, the experience you've had working together, that's really what's going to sell an investor, as well as obviously the larger vision. Not thinking big enough. I think a lot of entrepreneurs get really bogged down on the product they're building right now. But again, these investors want that $100 million business or that $1 billion business, and they want to have a clear picture of how you're going to get there. So making sure that you not only articulate the customer pain point that you're addressing right now, but your larger vision for your business, it's super important. Not talking milestones. We get pitched all the time, and this is like an automatic ding for us and I think a lot of other investors, when we hear entrepreneurs say, this is what we're going to do when we get money. Like, we haven't done anything yet, but when we get money, we're going to do all these awesome things. We would much rather hear about the sort of few very small specific things you've been able to accomplish with nothing or very little than all the things you might do. So hearing that you did research, you built out a test project, you did customer interviews, you iterated on that, and you now have 10 paying customers who are just obsessed with your product is much more compelling to us than knowing that you have, you know, 100,000 customers that you could get if you could just get 20K from me. Not making an ask, you'd be surprised how many people don't ask me for money or anything else. And similarly, we see this all the time with investors. So like we invite investors to come in and meet with our companies all the time. And sometimes they'll walk out with not having had anything asked of them, which makes me nuts. We always try to tell our companies, always ask for something. Maybe it's money. Maybe it's a follow-up meeting. Maybe it's just saying, I want your email so I can keep you up to date with our product and what we're up to. It's incredibly important. You know, a typical micro VC gets pitched maybe 10 times a week, maybe 50 times a week. The likelihood of their ability to remember you is very low. And so if they can have touch points, things to remember you, like you asked a question if they were teaching a class or you sent them a follow-up email once a month, they're more likely to remember you and be invested in kind of taking the time to give you feedback or talk to you or invest in you.
Quick break from Claire for some recent startup headlines. Yahoo has reached an agreement to sell its 48.6-acre plot in Santa Clara to the Chinese electronics company LeEco. The terms of the deal are still undecided. Yahoo purchased the site in 2006 for $106 million, but abandoned its plan to build a 3 million square foot office space. Microsoft has withdrawn its financial support from the Republican National Convention. The move comes after multiple advocacy groups put pressure on the company. Microsoft will continue to provide technical and financial support for the Democratic National Convention. Delta has announced a new baggage tracking program that would use RFID scanners. It will equip 344 airports with the readers. Delta hopes to bring the typical 95% bag check accuracy rate up to 99.9%. Let's get back to Claire's presentation.
Definitely recognizing that this is going to take time. We always hear about these startups and our companies oftentimes worry and wring their hands because they say like, oh, we heard about this company and they raised in 2 weeks or they raised in a month. I promise you that doesn't happen. That's never happened or very, very almost never happens. All of those stories are super embellished. It takes a really long time to raise money, and especially in a market like today, it could take 3 months, it could take 9 months. We oftentimes encourage our companies to pick one person on their team to really be that fundraising person. We often find when a team dedicates sort of 50% of their time to their business and 50% of their time to fundraising, things just inevitably fall through the cracks. So much better to have one person who has it kind of all on their shoulders. It kind of sucks, but you know, say spending 85% of their time, you know, just living, breathing, thinking about fundraising. You know, they wake up every morning and they look at their Google spreadsheet and they see who they have to follow up with. It's just a lot neater, cleaner, and you're much more likely to get through it more quickly. That's it. So I don't know if you guys have any questions, but I'm happy to answer either specific questions about your fundraising strategy or anything else you might have.
So please line up here for a question.
Yes, my question is when you mentioned about making that ask. So say, for example, if I am raising $600,000 and I've heard a lot of different ways of people saying going about it, they would ask for advice first. How do you kind of go about making that ask of saying, okay, this is what I'm raising, this is our milestones? Could you talk a little bit on that?
Sure. I mean, I think it depends upon the investor, and doing your research about the style of each investor is really important. I would say don't shy away from the fact that you're fundraising. If you're talking to an investor, they're really busy. They want to know what you want. It's a lot easier to ask an investor for money if they've spent some time getting to know your business over time, say, like before you're ready to fundraise, start getting them up to speed with your product. You know, start reaching out to those investors, build relationships with them ahead of time so that it's sort of like that, you know, ask for advice when you want money. But when it is time to ask for money, just ask.
Hi, my name is Alejandro. I'm doing a sports prediction application. We've done a prototype, beta, if you want to call it. And I've approached some people, but all the time I get the, we need traction. So I'm like in the pre-seed thing. Obviously, I show my financials of what I think, my forecast. And I try to go conservative, not to say like, oh, I'm going to have 100 million users in the first year, you know?
Yeah.
So is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? What about the pre-seed? What are your...
So pre-seed is so hot right now. Everybody's raising a pre-seed round, it seems like. And, you know, obviously there are different expectations in terms of performance with pre-seed. It's much more about, you know, getting through a pilot and really making sure you've perfected your product. And I would say that it's really... I'm not a sports startup expert, but I think traction is really important, especially if you're looking for a consumer-facing product. The numbers that investors are looking for are just going up. So I would focus, you know, obviously you want to have a big picture, like, you know, you want to be realistic and you also want to be large, but in terms of focusing on what those investors want to see, it's going to be really passionate customers, customer feedback, if you can have quotes, if you can have surveys, if you can have user testing data that you can provide to show that not only do you have a lot of early stage customers, but you have really passionate early stage customers, that's probably your best bet.
Thank you.
Hi, Clara. My name is William, and I'm from a mental health startup. So we connect users with therapists for online counseling through audio, video, via PC, mobile. So just wanted to ask, do you guys go into life science, and, you know, what's the strategy? You know, you didn't share anything about the life science there, so just wanted to ask about
sure.
that.
I mean, we haven't, I don't think we've done any life science companies to date. We are not against it, but for us, like, our lens is, you know, is this a major problem that mayors care about and that we can kind of target? So it's definitely something we'd be open to, but haven't sure. done it to date.
We do have a social impact at heart as well, so we do want to, you know, help individuals with low income, you know, and families as well. So
that's awesome.
Why, yeah. That's
yeah, I mean, I think a lot of times the companies that may not seem like total traditional fits for Tumble, but that we end up selecting, it's because they can somehow integrate with public service delivery. So whether you're integrating with public hospitals or maybe mental health facilities that are targeting low and moderate income communities, that's one way it might overlap.
Sure, sounds good. I'd love to talk to you more about that.
I have a question about that slide you had, talking about kind of making the vision larger or large. So we're about to have our starter seed round, and we're an education technology company, and kind of balancing this sense that we do have a really large vision at the end of the day if someone wanted to talk to us enough about it, but balancing feasibility with opportunity, because it seems like as the vision gets larger, the apparent feasibility does get less. So kind of how do you balance that between staying within education technology and saying we see this being a consumer product across the world?
What is your big one?
We're starting with an education, and it's a sizable market.
Yeah.
But wanting to know, like, when we pitch, should we make that leap to say we're going to be going across, first of all, multiple verticals outside of education, and then second of all, this is just the way to make a consumer product ultimately?
I think for our seed stage investors, they really do want to have something that's sort of exciting and motivating them, like saying, like, we're a big data solution for water utilities. Like, no one's like, oh, yeah, like, that sounds amazing. But saying, like, we're going to solve California drought is very compelling to early stage investors. So I think you do need to paint that really, like, large picture. I think the line to walk is really that you want to focus on very specific, like, we're starting in preschools and then we're going to upsell in X way, or we're starting in, you know, one education vertical and then, you know, just being able to very specifically articulate the process and not just say, like, we're going from 0 to 100, but sort of being able to walk through maybe in the second to last slide of your deck what that process might look like and how long it might take, I definitely think is good.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Brian. You talked a little bit about the raising bar for Series A rounds, as well as how trendy pre-seed rounds are right now.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about kind of the economics behind that and sort of where the capital is coming from that's earmarked for accelerators and pre-seed rounds?
Sure. So the capital for accelerators is typically coming from folks who are looking to bundle their early stage seed investments, as well as in our case, a lot of our funding is philanthropic in nature. So like folks like Omidyar Network, who are really interested in getting a lot of new companies out there, and that's really their motivation, and they have different sort of performance expectations than, say, an LP in a major venture capital fund. I think the economics behind it are kind of what I was talking about earlier, which is the sort of performance expectations of, say, that $1 billion versus $100 million, and as many of you might be seeing in the news, the unicorns phenomenon means it's that much harder to find those unicorns, and so I think investors are just getting a little skittish, and so the likelihood of investing in a company without a lot of traction is just super low. So that bar is just really the phenomenon of having to get to that billion and then also having all of these freakouts in the paper, which basically show how hard it is to actually get there.
Thank you.
That makes sense.
Hi, I have a question about raising a seed round and networking with potential investors. What would you recommend as getting in touch with people? And also whether we should try to target people who invested previously in our relevant industry. How important is that?
I think it depends upon your industry. A lot of our companies have found success, especially in sort of more unusual industry verticals. Searching AngelList literally for folks who have affinity along that issue area, that's been really successful. A lot of companies join like industry area, like industry organizations, like professional organizations, unions, things like that, that can be really great networking opportunities. That's been really helpful. I think it really depends upon your industry vertical. What is your industry vertical?
Travel industry.
Travel. Uh-huh. I'm sure there are lots of travel associations that you might join, which might not seem super intuitive, like they may not be investors themselves, but they're probably super well connected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Hi there. My name is Dave. So I have what I think is a great idea, but I'm not a technical guy, and so I kind of jumped the gun and started the company, and now I'm looking for either a technical founder and or the capital, you know, to build the thing.
Yeah.
And so in my searching, I came to find, I was interested in applying for an incubator, and I came to find that somebody involved in that incubator has funded a startup that is in the same space, so it would be like a competitor, kind of similar. So I'm wondering, is it smart to go ahead and start, you know, should I like completely run away from them and avoid that? Because I don't want them to know, like, or, you know, go and say, oh, here's what somebody's about to try to make.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I'd say most accelerators invest in competitors all the time. YC is famous for investing in competitors, for example, all the time. Okay. So the likelihood of you finding an accelerator that won't is very low.
Okay.
And similarly, like early stage investors might invest in multiple companies that kind of, especially if you have like an industry area, like an angel that only invests in water, say, the likelihood of having some competitors in the portfolio is pretty high.
Okay.
I'd also say, like, we get asked a lot, like, should we make investors sign an NDA before they talk to us? And we say, like, absolutely not. No investor will even consider signing an NDA, or on the off chance that they do, we've definitely heard from investors, and again, this is super unethical, but they will just sign it and then ignore it. So we try to tell our companies, especially at the early stage, your ideas, and this is not just you, this is all early stage companies, your idea is probably not that original. It has a lot more to do with your ability to execute and your team, which is why it's probably most important for you to focus on finding a technical co-founder right now.
Okay.
It's much more about execution. I mean, we've gotten like 8 LinkedIn for the formerly incarcerated applications, you know, and I've looked at all of them. They're all great, but we're going to end up picking the one that has the best team, for example.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, Clara. My name is Param Yarmandra. I'm the founder and CEO of Rovi Inc. What we are trying to do is we are using speech recognition and artificial intelligence for enterprise mobile apps, trying to increase the purchase conversion rates on a mobile device. Now, one of your slides, it talks about the valuation raising 500 to 2 million. You have to forego 33% of your stake, that one. Now, is that applicable for B2C or B2B or both, or even for products, physical products?
So we don't do a lot of hardware, but I would say in general, this is what we see for pretty much all seed stage investments in terms of the amount of your company that you should give up.
Okay.
I think some hardware companies end up raising more money, but they end up giving a comparable percentage of their company away just by virtue of what they have to develop. But this is the typical equity loss that you should expect to receive.
And do you invest in B2B as well, or is it only B2C?
We find that we don't actually invest in that many strictly B2C. Most of our most successful companies, this is just something we've noticed lately, are investing across customer profiles. So they'll be B2G and B2B, or they'll be B2C and B2G. Partly, I think this is just like a growth strategy, and partly it's a really smart counter-cyclical strategy. So we'll have a company that sells to like both private water utilities and public water utilities, or they'll start by selling to private schools and then they'll sell charter schools and then they end up selling public schools. And that's really compelling, we found, to a lot of investors. They want to know that, especially in a market like today, you have the flexibility of being able to target multiple types of customers and potentially weather the questionable future a little bit more smoothly by virtue of being able to turn on a dime and target a customer that might be a little bit more willing to pay.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, my name is Mike, and I'm from Orange County. So I was just wondering whether, because you're located in the Valley and you seem to be investing in the Valley companies, do you have a preference for being in the Valley, or do you actually accept to invest in companies outside of the Valley?
Two-thirds of our applicant pool comes from outside of the Bay Area, and I think about 50% of our portfolio is actually from outside the Bay Area. So we definitely look elsewhere. I mean, for us, the real sign of success is a company's ability to be able to scale beyond wherever their initial hometown was. So for example, Neighborly was from Kansas City, and for us it was like, okay, could this work in Kansas City and then also work in San Francisco and LA and Nashville and Detroit?
Hi, my name is Guy from buymylemonade.com.
Hi.
And we are in a mission to turn 44 million K-12 students into 44 million young entrepreneurs by a platform that allowed them to fundraise socially for their schools instead of selling chocolate bars and cookies. However, similar to him, we're from Canada. Are you guys investing in outside the country companies?
So we've invested in international companies, but they, for the most part, are incorporated in the U.S. And I think you'll find, in general, U.S., especially early stage investors, like to be really hands-on with their companies. So you'll find in general, I think especially at the earliest stages, these investors want to be nearby. That's not to say it doesn't happen or that we wouldn't, but I think it's a lot more typical.
Yep, thank you.
Hi, I came in a little bit late because I was leaving a main stage talk, so forgive me if I ask a question you've already answered.
No worries
about
it.
Let me know. I have two questions, actually. I'm in a company that's seeking angel investment, and right now we have a couple big questions coming up. One, how do we set a valuation?
How do you set a valuation? That's a tough one. I think it really depends on your business. I think a lot of our companies end up talking to their bankers. So there are certain banks that really specialize in this. So like First Republic Bank works with all of our portfolio companies to kind of back into what they think their valuation is, and the best way to do that is usually through market comps. So looking at AngelList, what companies that are similar to yours have raised, as well as, especially with banks, because they have a lot of proprietary knowledge. They may not tell you the name, but they can tell you this is a comparable business or comparable industry. They're more likely to know what a company raised at that might be similar to yours and kind of be able to advise you in terms of pegging yourself appropriately in the space.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. And the other question is, I've been talking to VCs and angels, and I'm hearing two different answers for this question. Is it better to go for the angel round for equity or convertible debt?
So almost all of the seed rounds that we see getting raised are on some kind of convertible instrument, whether it's convertible debt or convertible equity. So like at Tumble, we started offering convertible equity. We found it was more founder friendly, and you'll see a lot of angels who like that. Yeah, I just think the majority of funding that you raise at that stage will probably be in a convertible format, just because, especially if you're a founder, you kind of want to punt the valuation as long as you can. And so by raising on a debt instrument or a note instrument like that, you can kind of avoid it for a little bit longer.
All right, thank you very much.
Uh-huh.
Okay, I guess this is the last question. my question is on traction. So we are an education-based company, K-12, and we are piloting in about a dozen schools. Do we have to have a revenue? We are pre-revenue company, so for seed round, do we have to have revenue, or is there some flexibility on that?
I think different investors have different expectations, especially angels and micro VCs and the sort of like pre-seed stage investors. It's much more about having a really passionate customer base, being able to show metrics like repeat usage and amount of time, say, an individual is using your product, as opposed to necessarily being able to generate revenue, although you should be able to say, draw a very clear line that says, like, on average, a customer is spending X amount of time on our product every single day, and we think that, you know, we've done, you know, 100 customer interviews, and they've indicated a willingness to pay of Y, and so we know when we switch it on, they're still going to stay, and things like that.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. One quick thing I'm going to just jump in, because I realize people have been asking me about a lot today, like, should you accept lots of little checks or try and target larger rounds? It obviously depending on your business, but we've definitely heard from a lot of angels, the kind of angels who target Tumble type companies, saying that they want a lead investor if they're going to participate in a round. The sort of party round phenomenon is kind of dying out, that they really want to know that there's someone who ultimately is going to be there managing your company and being accountable, making sure that you stay accountable to the targets you've set for yourself. So just something to be aware of. A lot of investors are really interested in knowing, you know,
what kind of governance role larger investors are going to be taking in your company. Additionally, there's this sort of larger phenomenon of moving away from growth-related metrics and really asking a lot of our companies, we see a lot of investors asking our companies about unit economics, so making sure that you have really solid answers around your unit economics would be highly advisable.
Hi, Abhishek Agarwal, founder of Crowdify.
Hey.
So you were talking about managing Excel, and so I know Angel List is a great place to find a lot of angels. Do you have other sources? And how do you find around, like, should you have a list of 100, 1,000? How many people you should start when you're looking to raise?
We usually tell our companies when they're starting to fundraise to pull out a spreadsheet, a Google spreadsheet that they share with us, any other early stage sort of supporters, investors that they trust, as well as their entire team, and then you should come up with a list of at least 100 targets. And they should do, you know, anyone they've heard of that invests in similar companies, anyone they've read about who they believe in, anyone that they're vaguely related to, and start there and really do like a very thorough fine-tooth comb tackling of that list before moving beyond it. But that's usually a good place to start. Your list end up gets much, much bigger as you grow, but 100 is usually where we tell our companies to start. AngelList, in terms of finding angels, is probably your best bet. Obviously, there are a lot of like newsletters like Strictly VC and things that you could start reading that you'll start to hear certain angel names or early stage investor names repeatedly, and that's also a good place. But yeah, AngelList is great.
So thank you very much, Clara, for your time.